Imagine giving a group of 10-year-olds 1 single hour to build a space rocket from scratch.
Oh, that sounds chaotic.
Right. You give them the materials, you start the clock, and, you know, with absolute certainty that their first design is going to completely collapse.
Because of course it is.
Yeah, and in fact, you're counting on it. So why would a school intentionally engineer failure into its curriculum?
That is the big question.
Welcome to today's deep dive. If you are listening to this, you're likely a parent in the Ashwell Primary School community.
And if you are, congratulations, you've survived to the end of the first half of the summer term.
Barely survived. May 2026 is in the books.
It is always just a total sprint to this point in the year, isn't it? And the sheer volume of output from the school really reflects that pace.
It really does. So we have our hands on the latest Ashwell School newsletter, dated May 22nd.
A hefty one, too.
Huge. And normally, you know, when parents see a newsletter, they just scan it for the logistical nightmares.
Right. You look for the inset days.
Exactly. Those mandatory teacher training days where you suddenly have to like scramble for childcare, you check the lunch menus, and then you just stick it to the fridge.
Guilty as charged.
But our mission today is to look past that administrative surface. We are going to sift through this enormous update and really highlight the sheer variety of enrichment activities that have been taking place.
Because there's a lot going on under the hood here.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because looking at this list, I mean, from ancient history trips to engineering challenges, it feels less like a schedule of fun events and more like we're looking at the school's underlying operating system.
I love that. That operating system analogy is actually the perfect lens for this material.
You think so?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because a standard curriculum, you know, the math, the reading, the science, those are just the individual apps.
Right, the stuff they have to do.
Yeah, but the enrichment activities detailed in this newsletter, those are the core code running in the background.
Ah, I see.
They're designed to teach children the mechanism of how to learn, how to fail safely, and how to physically interact with the world around them.
Okay, let's start with how they're interacting with history, because year four essentially got dropped into a time warp.
They really did.
We are talking about the Celtic Harmony Camp.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this wasn't just like a regular field trip. It was an overnight residential stay where they were fully immersed in Celtic Britain.
That is intense for year four.
It is. They did archery, den building, warrior training, a Flintstone workshop, foraging, and drumming.
Drumming, of course.
And they actually slept in a real Celtic roundhouse.
See, the pedagogical term for this is embodied cognition.
Embodied cognition. Okay, what does that actually mean?
It's the idea that our minds are not separate from our physical bodies. When a child just reads about, say, Celtic foraging in a textbook, the brain just files that under abstract data.
Right, it's just words on a page.
Exactly. But when a child is physically on their knees in the dirt, smelling a wood fire, and sleeping in a circular structure instead of their square bedroom,
Which is wild to think about.
the brain encodes that information completely differently. The sensory input anchors the historical
Okay,
facts.
I buy the sensory anchoring, but I have to push back a little bit here.
Go for it.
When kids are out there building dens and doing, you know, warrior training, aren't they just doing high-end live-action role play?
Like they're just playing.
Yeah, they think they're playing.
Right.
What is the actual measurable takeaway when they come back to a modern classroom?
Well, the historical knowledge is almost a secondary benefit here.
Wait, really?
Yeah. The primary mechanism at work is forced psychological autonomy.
Oh, interesting.
Think about it. For many of these year four students, this is the first time they are spending the night away from their parents in a peer group setting.
That's true. They're only, what, 8 or 9 years old?
Exactly. So when a child wakes up in a totally unfamiliar environment, like a literal roundhouse, and has to manage their own belongings, navigate their own morning routine.
Without mom or dad yelling at them to find their shoes.
Precisely. They have to negotiate space with their peers without a parent buffering that friction. They are building new neural pathways for resilience.
That makes total sense. You're basically stripping away their usual scaffolding.
That's a great way to put it.
And speaking of scaffolding, they didn't just look at ancient history, they also looked at local history, right? Year four visited the historic Arbory Banks and the Ashwell Museum,
Yeah.
and they got talks from local experts, Sarah Talks and Kate Haddock.
Which is just a brilliant sequencing of events by the school.
How so?
Well, at the Celtic camp, they experienced the psychological lifestyle of the past, right? But by bringing them back to Arbory Banks, the school is teaching them the geography of the past.
Oh, tying it to their actual hometown?
Exactly. They are standing in the actual landscape they've been studying. It teaches a child that history is not this abstract concept that only happens in London or Rome.
Right. It's not just museums far away.
No, history is the ground under your own boots, in your own village.
I love that. So if the history trips are about navigating the physical unknown of the past, let's look at how the school handles the cognitive unknown of the future.
Let's do it.
The newsletter highlights some really intense STEM challenges: science, technology, engineering, and math.
Ah, yes.
And this brings us back to that rocket building scenario I mentioned at the start.
The year 5 and 6K NX challenge.
Yes. A visiting STEM ambassador came in and gave the teams literally 1 hour to design and build a space rocket.
And then they had to present their features to the room, right?
Yeah, full presentation. First place medals went to Tilly and Amora in year 5 and John and Dougie in year 6.
Huge congratulations to them.
Definitely. But what absolutely fascinated me was a quote in the newsletter from a year 5 student, Kieran.
What did he say?
When asked about the day, Kieran said, "The KNX was fun to do, especially the trial and error part."
Oh, wow.
I know. I read that and immediately thought, in what universe does a modern 10-year-old enjoy trial and error?
It's pretty rare.
We live in an era where, like, if an app takes 3 seconds to load, kids, and let's be honest, adults, we just abandon it.
You are touching on a massive cultural issue there. The intolerance for friction.
Yeah, exactly.
We largely bubble wrap children's cognitive experiences to prevent frustration. But an artificial constraint, like a strict 1 hour ticking clock to build a complex structure,
it completely changes the game.
It changes the psychological stakes.
But how? Because my instinct says a ticking clock just creates panic.
It does create pressure, yes. But it also bypasses perfectionism.
Oh, I see.
When you only have 60 minutes, you know your first attempt will fail. The structural integrity will be compromised, or the design just won't stand up.
Right. It's literally impossible to be perfect on the first try.
Exactly. By making failure an inevitable part of the hour, the school is redefining success.
That's really powerful.
Success is no longer getting it right the first time. Success becomes how quickly you can pivot, how well you delegate roles to your teammate, and how you regulate your own emotional frustration when the KNX structure snaps in half at the 45-minute mark.
So they are essentially doing stress inoculation training, but it's disguised as a toy building exercise.
West Bond.
And we see that exact same architecture of pressure in the year 3 and 4 maths challenge.
Right, the inter-schools competition run by Hertz Education.
Yes, and this was not kids sitting quietly at individual desks filling out addition worksheets.
Far from it.
This was a team competition. They had problem solving, visual estimation, and shape activities. And the catch, strict 2-minute timed rounds.
2 minutes. That is intense.
2 minutes to solve complex math as a team. I mean, my palms are sweating just thinking about it.
The mechanism there is cognitive flexibility.
Okay, unpack that for me.
When a child does math alone at their kitchen table, they only have to convince themselves of the answer.
You just write it down.
But when they have 120 seconds to solve a spatial estimation problem with 3 other peers, they have to synthesize information, vocalize a strategy, listen to a counter strategy, and agree on an outcome before the buzzer.
All in 2 minutes.
It takes math out of the realm of isolated academia and turns it into a high-stakes social negotiation.
Okay, so we are seeing a really clear pattern here. The school is intentionally introducing controlled friction.
Yes, absolutely.
Friction of sleeping away from home, the friction of a collapsing KNX rocket, the friction of a math timer.
That's all deliberate.
But let's look at what happens when the environment is no longer controlled. Let's talk about navigating the actual physical world.
Okay.
The newsletter places a huge emphasis on active travel this half term.
Yes. The school council officially opened the new active travel garden,
which was funded by the Henry Colburn Trust and the PTA. Really.
The Parent Teacher Association, exactly. And they live streamed the opening in Friday's assembly.
Which is a lovely touch. And that tied directly into Walk to School Week, which they branded as Mission Move. That's a great name. But here's where it gets really interesting for me. They didn't just issue a blanket statement saying, you know, walking to school is healthy, please do it.
Right, which rarely works.
They turned it into a 5-day psychological operation.
They really did.
Monday was mental health, focusing on feeling calmer before learning. Tuesday was road safety.
Wednesday was physical health.
Thursday was sustainability and air quality. And Friday was community connection.
It's brilliant.
They gave the children a different lens through which to view the exact same physical action every single day.
That layered approach is how you actually drive behavioral change.
Because it gives them a reason to care.
Yes. If you just say, it's good for your heart, A 7-year-old cannot conceptualize cardiovascular health.
Right, they don't care about their cholesterol.
Exactly. But they can conceptualize feeling less anxious on a Monday or seeing their neighbor on a Friday.
That makes so much sense.
And more importantly, they paired this philosophy with direct physical training.
Right. Year 2 did scootability training with the Hertz County Council.
Scootability, I love that word.
Learning the actual mechanics of starting, stopping, and steering safely. But year 4 went out with the Safer Travel Team for pedestrian training, and they didn't do it on the school playground with some orange traffic cones.
No, they did not.
They went out into the actual village.
Which is so important. Learning hazard awareness in a real-world environment is vital for spatial mapping.
Spatial mapping, like building a map in their head.
Exactly. When children are constantly driven to school, their brains do not actively map their environment. They are just passive passengers.
Staring at an iPad in the back seat.
Usually, yes. But when they are out on the actual pavements, learning to navigate dropped curbs, identifying blind spots in driveways, and practicing the mantras stop, look, listen, think with real cars driving past.
They are building an internal GPS.
They are.
So we're talking about the architecture of risk. It's the complete opposite of that bubble wrap parenting we discussed earlier.
Precisely. And this presents a genuine challenge for the parents listening.
Uh-oh, brace yourselves.
Well, the default for many of us is convenience. We are late, it is raining, we just put the kids in the car and drive the half mile to school.
I mean, we've all done it.
We have.
Yeah.
But every time we default to convenience, we are depriving our children of the necessary friction required to build spatial autonomy.
Wow.
We are trading their long-term independence for our short-term schedule.
That is a really tough pill to swallow, but a necessary one. If we want them to be capable in the world, they actually have to interact with it.
They do.
And interacting with the community brings us to our final theme from the newsletter.
The big picture.
Right. We've looked at the individual child navigating history, failing at math challenges, and mapping their streets. Now, let's zoom out and look at the school as a social ecosystem.
The community integration over the last few weeks has been really extensive.
It really has. Let's look at the Ashwa Music Festival at St. Mary's Church.
Yeah.
The school choir performed Miley Cyrus's The Climb. But the standout visual for me was the brand new boys choir making their debut.
Their very first public performance.
And they sang Waving Flag, but they sang it to the beat of a djembe drum.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Just picture the acoustic clash of that moment. Mm-hmm. You have the historic, echoing traditional architecture of St. Mary's Church, which is a total staple of the village.
Right. Very traditional.
And it is being filled with this vibrant, rhythmic, very modern, percussive energy from these young boys. It is a brilliant collision of demographics.
And that collision is totally intentional.
You think they planned it that way?
Absolutely. A school can easily become a silo. Right. Just isolated from the rest of the town.
Mm.
Bringing a djembe drum into a traditional church is a sonic representation of bridging gaps.
That's a beautiful way to look at it.
And we see that same bridging of demographics in the Year 3 intergenerational project.
Yes. Throughout April and May, Year 3 spent time doing creative cookery and arts and crafts with local community elders.
Such a great initiative.
Now, a cynic might look at that and say, okay, it's a glorified playdate. They're just baking cookies. What is the actual developmental mechanism happening when an 8-year-old cooks with an 80-year-old?
The mechanism is empathy and historical continuity.
Okay, expand on that.
Modern society is heavily age segregated. Children spend their days with peers their exact age, and elders are often isolated.
That's very true.
By artificially forcing these two demographics together over a shared tactile task like cooking, the school is recreating the historical concept of the village.
It takes a village.
Exactly. The children learn to modulate their communication style, to listen to slower cadences of speech, and to see themselves as part of a timeline that extends far beyond their own immediate needs.
It weaves them into the social fabric, which is exactly what we see happening with the broader wins celebrated in the newsletter.
There were quite a few individual wins.
Tons of them. You have Hector in year 6 making the Hertfordshire County basketball A team.
Amazing achievement.
You have Hector S. and Marlo B. winning the school chess competition. And beautifully, you have the local scouts volunteering their evening to come and do odd jobs around the school site.
That is the feedback loop of civic pride in action.
A feedback loop.
Think about it. The local trusts and the PTA invest money in the active travel garden. The scouts invest sweat equity into maintaining the grounds.
Ah.
And in return, the children invest their artistic energy into the church, and their social energy into the elders. It is a reciprocal ecosystem.
Everyone feeds into each other. Which brings us to perhaps the most universally understood community moment in any primary school in this country. The end of Key Stage 2 SATs.
The standard assessment tests.
Yes.
The culmination of the primary academic journey.
And a stressful one. The year 6 cohort finished these massive high-pressure national exams. And how did the school choose to celebrate?
Let me guess, more math.
Nope. Did they give them more academic awards? No. They gave them a non-uniform day and took them on a trip to Ashwell Springs.
That is perfect.
After weeks of standardized, heavily monitored, deeply stressful cognitive output, they just let them be kids, splashing around in a natural water source.
It is the ultimate psychological decompression.
Because they just need a break.
It's more than a break. Yeah. You cannot sustain the level of cognitive pressure required for SATs without a corresponding release.
Right.
Taking them to Ashwell Springs shifts their nervous systems from the sympathetic fight or flight of the exam hall back to the parasympathetic rest and digest state.
It literally changes their biology.
Yes. It reminds them that while their test scores matter, their physical joy and connection to nature matter just as much.
So if we look back at the operating system we've been decoding today, I mean, it is incredibly complex.
Highly complex.
The school is using Celtic roundhouses to force autonomy. They are using ticking Canon X clocks to bypass perfectionism and redefine failure.
Exactly.
They are using the physical streets of the village to build internal risk assessment maps. And they are using djembe drums and cooking classes to weave these children into the larger societal fabric.
It is a phenomenal amount of deliberate architectural work happening behind the scenes of what just looks like a list of fun events.
It really is. But as much as we have championed all this active learning, you know, the building, the walking, the singing, the constant motion, there is a section deep in this newsletter that offers a radically different perspective on how kids process all this.
You're referring to the SEND spotlight.
Yes, the section dedicated to special educational needs and disabilities. The local NHS speech and language service provided a spotlight on selective mutism.
Which is such an important topic.
It is. They explain that this is an anxiety-based difficulty where a child might speak completely normally at home, but physically freeze up and become unable to speak in a high-pressure environment like school.
And the crucial distinction they make is that it is not defiance.
Right. They aren't just being stubborn.
No, it is a genuine anxiety-induced inability to vocalize.
And the guidance they gave to parents on how to support these children was really striking. They explicitly advised against pressuring the child to speak.
Which is our instinct, right? To push them.
Yeah, exactly. They said avoid phrases like, just tell them. But the piece of advice that really stopped me in my tracks was when they said, value all communication.
Wow. Value all communication.
Gestures, writing, nodding. Give the child time and space without the demand for a verbal performance.
It is a profound piece of psychological advice because it strips away our adult ego.
What do you mean by adult ego?
Well, we often measure a child's well-being by how much data they verbally report to us. If they tell us a lot, we feel like good parents.
I see. And I want to take that highly specific clinical advice and apply it broadly as a final challenge for every single parent listening to this deep dive.
I like where you're going with this.
Even if your child does not struggle with selective mutism, think about the sheer volume of sensory and cognitive input they are experiencing right now.
It's massive.
We've just spent the last 15 minutes outlining a world of warrior training, timed math panics, scooter hazard avoidance, and acoustic performances.
Their brains are operating at absolute maximum capacity.
Exactly. So tonight, when your child walks through the front door, what is your immediate default?
We usually interrogate them, don't we?
Yes. Do you immediately demand a verbal performance? Do you pepper them with questions? How was the math challenge? Did your K&X rocket work? What did the elder say when you baked?
And we ask these things out of love, out of a genuine desire to connect.
Of course we do. But in doing so, we are often just adding another cognitive task to an already exhausted brain.
That is so true. We're asking for a report.
Right. So my provocative thought for you to mull over is this. Are you leaving space for silence in your home?
That's a great question.
What if silence isn't an absence of communication, but a necessary form of processing that you actually need to respect?
It shifts the whole paradigm.
When your kid just gives you a tired nod or slumps against you on the sofa without saying a word about their day, value that nonverbal communication.
Let them be quiet.
Recognize that it is their way of telling you that they have been out there fully engaged, navigating the friction of that incredibly demanding, beautiful operating system we call school.
It requires a lot of parental restraint to just let the silence exist.
It really does. But maybe that silence is exactly what they need to reboot for tomorrow.
I think you're absolutely right.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the Ashwell Primary School updates.
It's been a pleasure.
Keep looking past the logistics, keep allowing for the friction, and we will catch you on the next one.